Hi, this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. Whoa, we'll knock three times, and if you don't ever say again, you'll know where to find me. There's one bartender, you'll know where to find me. There's one bartender. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? From Little Rock, Arkansas, the Salty Dogs' feel-good country music has been hailed by critics and fans alike and has been featured on TLC's Trading Spaces as well as HBO's Rectify. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the beautiful and historic Argenta branch of William F. Lehman Public Library. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark can be heard on blues legend John Weston's CDs, Blues at Daybreak, and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight our featured artist is also our storyteller, painter Zeke Taylor, with these two pieces here. The first one, this larger piece here, called Sultry Mood. And this one over here, the smaller piece, titled To Recreate the Grandeur of the Ziegfeld Follies, Beulah Gladstone Built an Elaborate Set Inside Her Garage. Both of which are for sale. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and Zeke at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Originally from the Delta town of Marmaduke, Arkansas, Zeke Taylor's stylized watercolors are included in collections around the world. His work has been displayed four times at the Arkansas Arts Center, twice in the prestigious Delta Exhibition, and one of his watercolors is currently on display in the Arkansas Governor's Mansion. The recipient of the Arkansas Arts Council's 2012 Governor's Arts Award for Lifetime Achievement, Zeke gave a TEDx talk in Bentonville, Arkansas, and was named as the number one Northwest Arkansas artist to watch in 2014 by the Arkansas Democrat Gazette newspaper. Zeke lives and works in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, where he is the executive director of the Eureka Springs Artist Registry. Tonight, Zeke takes us back in time to his hometown and rebellious act in Pierced. Ladies and gentlemen, Zeke Taylor.
April 1972. I was back home at my parents' house for spring break from the Memphis College of Art when I noticed a strange-looking gold hoops lying on the sink in the bathroom. They were perfectly round, about the size of a nickel, with an opening that had a gold ball on one end and a very sharp point on the other end of the loop. Next to the hoops was an instruction pamphlet that read, "Place the earrings on the lobe, leave in place, and the earrings will self-pierce in a matter of weeks." I then realized that they belonged to my mother, who was going to use the devices to finally get something that she had wanted for a long time, pierced ears. I laid the hoops back down on the sink and walked to the kitchen, poured myself a cup of coffee, and laced it with a shot of my daddy's Old Crow. My parents were away for the day visiting my Aunt Verlene, and since I had the whole house to myself, I thought it was safe to have a little morning cocktail. I figured that my daddy wouldn't miss one shot of whiskey from the bottle that he kept hidden under the sink. He had bottles hidden here and there in a sock drawer, in the shed out back, under the seat of his old truck, and several other places. He hid the bottles thinking my mother wouldn't know just how much that he drank. She knew. If I was careful to get a little bit of whiskey from different bottles, he would never know that I was borrowing from his stash. As I sat there drinking that mixture of coffee and Old Crow, I was thinking about how happy I was to be enrolled in art school, a world so vastly different from the little Delta town in eastern Arkansas where I had grown up and where I'd picked cotton each fall. Even though I felt comfortable in that little town of 650, I never felt more comfortable than I did when I was with my fellow art students, a bohemian bunch who seemed to have a view of the world so unlike the Delta folk that I grew up with. I had found my tribe. There were even a couple of guys at school, sophisticated boys from up north, who had pierced ears. I admired their roguish fashion statement, but I did wonder if they were, when off campus, harassed and called sissy boys or worse. That was long before it was socially acceptable for a man to wear an earring. As I sat there at the kitchen table, with my fingers I traced the outline of the flowers on the plastic tablecloth, and I wondered how I would look with a pierced ear. Would I be brave enough, like those boys from up north, to wear an earring in public? I went to my daddy's sock drawer, found another bottle, and added a little more Old Crow to my coffee before returning to the bathroom. I placed one of the sharp-pointed earrings on my left lobe and lightly pressed. Ouch! Even in the dimly lit bathroom, illuminated with a single light bulb hanging about halfway down from a 13-foot ceiling, I could see that my earlobe was turning red. However, as I peered into the medicine cabinet mirror, I thought I looked dashing and somewhat debonair. A forward thinker, not restricted by the norms of society. I was so cool. My ear was really smarting, but I saw no blood. Oh, what the hell? It can hurt much more than it does right now. I reached up with my right hand and pushed the pointed end of the earring on through my lobe and out the other side. I cussed and fell to my knees in pain. Back on my feet and again peering into the mirror, I said out loud, "Well, I did it, and I'm glad as hell." I was thinking, wowee, I can't wait to get back to school to show off the shiny gold hoop to my friends. There was just one problem. In a few hours, my parents would return home. My earlobe had swelled to twice its normal size. I needed more whiskey. 17 years earlier, I had made the uncanny decision to become an artist. That year, I won the grand prize in the first grade contest with a crayon portrait of my mother. I drew her hair in fabulous circles with a crayon called Mahogany. And in the picture, I gave her almost perfectly round cheeks with a carnation pink crayon. As the winner, I had my choice of a big old peppermint stick or a chicle stick, a peanut butter toasted coconut coated concoction of a stick. I chose the chicle stick and devoured my prize during the next recess. After winning that contest, there was never any doubt in my mind that I wanted to become an artist. My parents were always accepting of whatever I did, not always understanding, but accepting, and that included my desire to have a career as an artist. They at times asked me, "Now, how do you make money doing that?" Besides my career choice, they accepted without question or criticism other things that I'd done that first year while in art school that seemed way off base to them, like letting my hair grow down past my shoulders, wearing raggedy bell bottoms, wearing strange sandals imported from India, and refusing to eat meat. Neither did they understand my practice of transcendental meditation. After all, they were Methodists. While I was sitting at the kitchen table on that day during my spring break, I kept thinking that I might have gone a little too far this time with the ear piercing. To have a son wearing an earring just might be too much for them. I spent a very long afternoon drinking even more spiked coffee Being careful not to take too much whiskey from any one bottle, I figured that the whiskey would calm my nerves while the coffee would keep me somewhat sober. Every so often, I ventured into the bathroom to look at myself in the mirror, admiring my new look, while at the same time regretting my action. I would douse my earlobe with rubbing alcohol, cuss some more at the stinging caused by the alcohol, but mostly I was just waiting and waiting and waiting. Time seemed to crawl, and I got more anxious. My ear continued to throb. It was going on 4 o'clock when I heard their car drive up. There was no mistaking the smooth purr from the V8 motor of my mother's Chrysler station wagon. My parents were home. As they got out of the car, I peered at them through the gingham curtains hanging above the kitchen sink. They looked happy enough. That seemed like a good sign. With my courage bolstered by the old crow, I bravely awaited my fate as they came into the house. However, when the doorknob turned, I didn't feel so brave. I made small talk, asked about their visit, while keeping my head turned at just the right angle so there would be no glint of gold. While my mother was sitting her purse on the table, she saw it. She tilted her head slightly to the side and gave it a little shake, like people do when they see something not quite right. She straightened her head up, and then to my surprise, all she said was, "How come you only pierced one ear?" My father didn't say a word. His silence continued for the next few days. On the last day of my spring break, my father and I were sitting in some lawn chairs out in the backyard under a mimosa tree. Even though it was not yet that hot, I could feel the sweat running down my spine from the nape of my neck all the way to my waistband, dampening my bell bottoms. I looked over at my father, who looked cool as a cucumber in a very dressy straw yellow hat with a green hat band. When not in the house, he always had on a hat. He was also wearing an orange-flowered Hawaiian shirt. My father was a very large man, and he seemed even larger when wearing those wildly colored shirts. But then, that was the only thing I can remember him ever doing that was outside of what I considered his safe zone. That day, he looked bigger than ever. I sat there on that green metal chair, getting hotter and more nervous by the minute. I was heading back to Memphis that afternoon, and I could not leave without knowing what my father was thinking and feeling. Was he disappointed in me, ashamed of me? He shifted a little in his chair, took a bottle from his back pocket, and took a swig. I couldn't stand it any longer. "Daddy, did you notice that I pierced my ear?" He looked me straight in the eye. "Yes, I saw the earring. It's your damn ear. You can do with it whatever you want to do." He continued, "There's a big world out there that I don't understand. You do. You need to do and should do whatever it takes to make you happy." I knew then that everything was going to be all right. Even after all these years, I'm glad that I pierced my ear. And yes, I still feel cool.
So thank you so much, Zeke Taylor, for being on the Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. In your story, you mentioned that in the Delta town of 650 people, well, where you grew up, which was called Marmaduke, I believe, great name, you pick cotton each fall. What was that like to grow up there? And do you have any stories about picking cotton or about your hometown?
It seemed like the normal thing to do to pick cotton where I grew up because everybody picked cotton. Mm. I started picking cotton when I was 5 years old. I went out with my grandmother. She made a little pick sack for me out of a pillowcase and put a strap on it. And everyone in town was out in the cotton patch. In school, we were out in the fall. We went to school in July and August, and then we were out in September and October for cotton harvest. So we were all out there. I was out there with my friends. I picked from the age of 5 all the way through my senior year of school. So I loved having that money. As a teenager, I was a pretty good picker. I could pick 300 to 400 pounds a day, and that was at 3 cents a pound. So I was making $9 to $12 a day. which for me at that age back then was a lot of money. It was enough money that at the age of 12, I bought a pony. At the age of 14, I bought a little Allstate motorcycle that I ordered out of the Sears catalog. And at 16, I bought a 53 baby blue Ford for $300. So I really loved working in the field. I was there with my friends. We would see who could pick the most. It was just a way of life. And I'm really glad that I had that experience.
Your parents sound wonderful and so accepting, especially with the raggedy bell bottoms, the strange sandals from India, and transcendental meditation. What about others in your hometown? Did you catch any flack from anyone else when you came home?
I really didn't. I think when a person grows up in a town of that size, 650 people, we grew up together. No one ever moved or moved in particularly. So we knew each other, we knew each other's families, so we were supportive of each other, even when we were not quite like everyone else. I think I grew up being different, but being accepted because everyone knew my family, knew my parents. And I think it was like a lot of small southern towns where people aren't critical or those that are different. They celebrate the eccentric. So I've always felt like when I've been there or talked with people that I've grown up with that I'm being celebrated. Sometimes they're curious because I do things that they haven't done or things they don't understand, but I don't think I've ever felt like they were being judgmental or critical of me. I've always felt loved by those people.
And so I think I remember reading that your mom was, she had a hair beauty salon, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about dancing there. Is there a story about that?
Or? Yeah. my mother was a hairdresser for almost 70 years up until the day she died. And that beauty shop was connected to the house where I grew up. So we'd be sitting in the living room watching TV, and women would be strolling past us in hair rollers going to the bathroom. But at night, that beauty salon, we called it a beauty shop, my mother thought salon was too highfalutin, became a teen hangout where we danced. In the town of Marmaduke, when I grew up, we couldn't dance at school. A lot of people in town thought dancing was a surefire ticket to hell. But my parents loved to dance, and they thought that we would be socially handicapped, my sisters and I, if we didn't know how to dance. So they took us to another town, and we had dance lessons for several years. So we shared those lessons with the other kids in town. Some of them we had to pull the blinds so the parents couldn't see them. But we would dance on that linoleum floor in that beauty shop. So it was the teen hangout. It was the place to dance. And because of my parents instilling that love of dance with me, I went on and I took additional lessons. And when I was in school in Memphis, I danced with Ballet South.
Almost like a Footloose kind of.
Yeah, it was definitely like Footloose in that town. But
I love the crayon portrait of your mom with the mahogany hair and carnation pink cheeks that you drew in the first grade. Have you done other portraits of your mom since the first grade?
I did one other one that I can think of, and that was, maybe 10 years ago. And I did it from an old photograph, and I think it was probably in the late 30s. She was sitting on the bumper of a car, all dressed up with a hat on, next to her grandmother, my great-grandmother, Vashti Ogles. But that's the only one I did. But I did do a portrait of my father this year from a photograph. And I'm in the photograph. I'm probably 5, and he's standing behind me. And he is big, and he does have on a Hawaiian shirt. And in that painting, I couldn't tell what color the shirt was from the photograph because it was black and white, of course. I made the shirt orange.
And was he wearing a hat?
He was wearing a hat, yes. Always wore a hat outside the house. When he would go to buy a new car, he would always make sure he had on his tallest hat so that he could make sure that he could fit in that car with that hat on. Or he wouldn't buy the car.
All right, well, we have a few minutes at the end here for audience questions.
I just recently read an article in the Arkansas Times where you recently got married, but that almost didn't happen. And could you relive that for us for just a second?
After being engaged for 42 years to a man, finally, it was legal in Arkansas for same-sex couples to be married. So Eureka Springs, where I live, is the only courthouse in the state that is open on Saturdays. So my partner, my fiancé of 42 years, and I were at the courthouse early on that Saturday morning. The deputy clerk, who was in charge because the regular clerk conveniently was out of town, refused to issue marriage license. There were people from all over the state there, same-sex couples there to be married. We stood our ground. We would not leave the courthouse. We wanted our legal right to be married. So she called the police. The police came. They ran us out. But another deputy clerk did step up and said that she would issue those marriage license. So, of course, the press was there. It was a emotional roller coaster after waiting 42 years with the same person to have the same rights as everyone else, to have those legal safeguards that married people have when it comes to property rights, hospital visitation, and that type of thing. That's what we wanted. That's what we deserved. So we stood our ground. We got our license. And I had a friend of mine waiting in the wings to marry us immediately, just in case there was a stay. So, and right now there is a stay, but I have my marriage license framed and in my home. So.
Zeke, tell us about Tip the Talking Dog.
Okay. I think you read this story on Facebook, but yeah. He's talking about when I was probably 4 years old, it was my job to feed the dogs. So my daddy had this bird dog named Tip, and we had a couple other dogs too. So went out to feed the dogs. I was carrying two bowls of food, one in a green bowl and one in a red bowl. And so I asked Tip, I said, do you want the green bowl or the red bowl? And Tip said, the green bowl. Well, I threw the bowls in the air and ran in the house to tell my mother that old Tip could talk. And it took her quite a while to explain to me that no, he couldn't, that my father was in an outhouse in the backyard. My father answered for Tip. So when my parents moved into that house, which was built in 1900, there was no indoor plumbing. So they put in plumbing. So we did have a bathroom in the house. But they kept the outhouse in the backyard, and it was a rather fancy one with a concrete cesspool under it. And we used it when we needed to. You know, with two sisters, sometimes it really came in handy. So.
Zeke, what brought you to Eureka Springs?
Eureka Springs has this energy about it that I think is really stimulating for creative people. And there are more artists there than per capita than most towns and cities in the United States. So I wanted to not only make art, I wanted to talk art. I wanted to be among peers. I wanted to share ideas. I wanted to support each other, stimulate each other. And I felt like because of the large art community in Eureka Springs that that would happen, and it definitely has happened.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Zeke Taylor, for being on our Tin Roof Project here on Tales from the South. You can find out more about Zeke, his life, and his work at ZekeTaylor.com. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is on location at and sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, with additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
I had this thought about 10 years or so ago. I know you go through construction all day long and see those orange barrels, and you see those big rigs that say oversized load on them. And I thought, if I wrote a song that said oversized load, and anytime anybody passes one of those, they think of our band. And so I wrote this song.
You oversized load, better pull to the side of the road, and you never, 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 never gonna slow me down. And you oversized load, you better pull to the side of the road, and making my living a dollar by the mile. And I'm picking them up, I'm laying them down, and I'm driving this rig from town to town. And you oversized load, you're never gonna slow me down. And I pulled out that asphalt starting to whine. Then I realized I was in Arkansas. And these barrels and barrels, as far as I can see, I tell you, this construction will be the death of me. And look here, mama, do you see what I see? You oversized load, you better pull to the side of the road, and you never, 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 never gonna slow me down. And you oversized load, you better pull to the side of the road, and making my living a dollar by the mile. And I'm pegging them up, I'm laying them down, driving this rig from town to town. And you oversized load, never gonna slow me down. And there he was with his light just shining bright, 30 and a 60, more than a ride. I tell you, son, you don't know who you're dealing with. Well, from San Francisco to San Bernardino, Santa Fe, Nashville, Reno, 40 tons of steel, son, you better recognize. You oversized load, you better pull to the side of the road. You never, 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 never gonna slow me down. And you oversized load, you better pull to the side. Oversized load, never gonna slow me down. And you oversized load, never gonna slow me down. And you oversized load, never gonna slow me down.
Rider accommodations provided by the Baker House Bed and Breakfast. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South.